area, like, say, Rocky Flats near Boulder, Colorado, you'd probably expect the state health officials to be on high alert to determine what's going on, if there's a danger, and what people should be doing about it. But then you hear from someone who has been on the ground with Rocky Flats for decades, and she tells you,
they're not looking at the health issues around Rocky Flats. They're not monitoring or documenting MS or any autoimmune diseases out there, diabetes, epilepsy, cancers. There's not a built-in alarm system that says, oh, wow, you know, there's been a lot of cases of brain cancer in the area. It takes community groups to request them to do analysis.
Our tax dollars not at work? Well, when you hear something like that, from a woman who has focused much of her life on finding out the Rocky Flats nuclear truth and forcing the government to do something about the known dangers, you begin to understand the nature of that uncomfortable seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a twofer. First, we talk with Tiffany Hansen. She is director of Rocky Flats Downwinders, and she'll be talking about two major studies that are taking place in that area. A health survey to determine the impact of living near the former plutonium pit production facility on the local community's health, and a new study on whether hemp can be used in phytoremediation of the plutonium-contaminated site. And then Donna Gilmore of San Onofre Safety gives us an update on San Onofre and the latest lies of omission by the folks burying dirty bombs on the beach of Southern California. Rushing to store multiple Chernobyl's worth of highly radioactive spent fuel rod waste in substandard canisters next to the ocean in an earthquake tsunami zone. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, an update on the radioactive Tokyo 2020 Olympics, and more honest nuclear information than John Bolton is likely to be sharing with Congress this week. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, January 28, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Well, it may not be 1 minute to midnight, as Bing Crosby sang, but it is closer than ever. According to the doomsday clock set by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, it is now 100 seconds to midnight. For over 70 years, the doomsday clock has been a metaphor for the likelihood of man-made international catastrophe that could destroy humanity. It was devised in 1947 by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and the symbolic clock face signifies the likelihood of man-made global annihilation. It's a metaphor for threats to humanity from unchecked scientific and technical advances. By resetting the clock from last year's 2 minutes to midnight to 100 seconds to midnight, which is the closest it has ever been to a full midnight, the scientists are signifying that this is a worsening of the crisis in the world and the worst since the Cold War under Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. As was explained by the bulletin, humanity continues to face two simultaneous existential dangers, nuclear war and climate change, that are compounded by a threat multiplier, cyber-enabled information warfare, that undercuts society's ability to respond. The international security situation is dire, not just because these threats exist, but because world leaders have allowed the international political infrastructure for managing them
to erode. Factors taken into account when setting the time this year were a rise in strident nationalism worldwide, President Donald Trump's comments on nuclear arms and climate issues, a darkening global security landscape, and a growing disregard for scientific expertise. This latest changing to the time on the doomsday clock has sparked important actions against the nuclear threat. Physicists are mobilizing to reduce the nuclear threat. With support from the American Physical Society, physicists from a collection of universities have recently begun a project to recruit and organize physicists to take on this challenge. The Physicists Coalition for Nuclear Threat Reduction plans, through grassroots efforts, to establish a network of citizen scientists committed to nuclear threat reduction. The participation of women, minority, and next-generation physicists, all of whom are currently underrepresented in nuclear policy debates, but whose voices must be part of such a new effort, will be a key ingredient. There's a great article about this from the Bulletin, and I'm going to link to it on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 449. One major step that has been happening is that today, the New York City Council took on the mayor's office for being so ill-prepared and laissez-faire about the need for nuclear war precautions and prevention. Dozens of activists from allied communities came together to address the New York City Council to divest from nuclear weapons along the lines of the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. They heard from the indigenous community, among whom was Ian Zabarte of the Western Band of the Shoshone Nation of Indians, New York municipal workers, pensions, and finance, the military and labor community, those allied with the United Nations and the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear War who spoke included Alice Slater of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. These are all people who will be familiar to those of you who listen to Nuclear Hot Seat regularly. Among the Hibakusha and Downwinders who spoke, the Hibakusha being those who were at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the Downwinders being those people who were downwind of the atmospheric nuclear tests, the elders were not able to attend, but their words were read by members of the Peace Boat Interns and included testimony by Janine Yazzie and Setsko Thurlow. The ecumenical community was represented, the scientific community, including a former FBI agent and a member of the Union of Concerned Scientists, the climate and environmental community, healthcare and medical community, the legal community, included Mare Inoue of the Manhattan Project for a Nuclear-Free World, and Jackie Cabasso of Western States Legal Foundation. And in the academic community, we were represented by, among others, Heidi Huttner, Ph.D. from Stony Brook University, filmmaker currently finishing off her documentary, Accidents Can Happen, The Women of 3 Mile Island. Gratitude to all who testified, and here's hoping that the city of New York takes a stand against nukes. More nonviolent action against nuclear weapons. On Monday, January 20th, Martin Luther King Day, in support of the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, six activists were arrested at Lockheed Martin Corporate Complex in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, the corporate complex of the world's number one war profiteer. They tolled a bell of peace. There was crime scene tape stretched across the driveway as five people attempted to deliver poster-sized copies of their statement of commitment to Lockheed Martin personnel. That statement, which was read aloud on site, started out, "We protest Lockheed Martin, the world's number one war profiteer, and its economy of war, from drone warfare technology to nuclear weapons and the forgotten but no less real peril of nuclear annihilation." Of course, Lockheed Martin could not take that lying down, and company security police vehicles blocked the delivery. Upper Marion police arrested the activists, and these activists are Paul Sheldon, Tom Mullion, Teresa Camarota, Robert M. Smith, and the Reverend Patrick Sieber. Each was cited for disorderly conduct and released from the Upper Marion police station. The activists said that they did what they did and they chose the day that they did because of the anniversary of Martin Luther King's birth, saying, "Dr. King looked down on us, we remembered, and looked up." And we'll link to an interesting article on the planned decommissioning of Indian Point by Holtec, a company well known for its substandard nuclear waste canisters, as can be attested to by the people around San Onofre and one of our interviewees later today, Donna Gilmore. The article from local New York publication The Gothamist is entitled, "Is the company poised to dismantle Indian Point too radioactive?" Well worth a read. It will be on nuclearhotseat.com, episode number 449. The concerns over Indian Point were supported by New York State Attorney General Letitia James, who leveled, quote, "multiple grave concerns," that's what she called them, about the third-party subsidiaries decommissioning the Indian Point nuclear power plant in Buchanan. James said in her statement that Holtec has no experience with, quote, "such an enormous, complex, and consequential undertaking." She also questioned whether the company had the proper financial resources to carry out the project. Over to Japan with an excellent article from theecologist.org. Forgetting Fukushima. It starts, "Irresponsible tactics are being used to bury social and environmental problems associated with the Fukushima nuclear disaster as the Olympics approach in Japan." We will link to this article on our website for this episode, as it is both extensive and important. And one cannot think about the radioactive Tokyo 2020 Olympics without thinking about that's Nuclear Hot Seat's new Olympic theme for everything that goes wrong with the Games. And now there's a question as to whether the torch relay or even the Olympics themselves will even be happening in the face of the fast-moving outbreak of the coronavirus, which is sweeping through the world. The last time we faced the threat of a pandemic of this sort was SARS in 2003, which reduced travel in Asia by 40% to 70%, and the epidemic took 4 months to burn out. Japan has already had its first confirmed case of coronavirus, and measures to contain the pandemic have included quarantining whole cities with millions of people in China, shutting down airports and scheduled flights to and from contaminated areas, and sold out supplies of N95 respirators to a public in terror of exposure. The Olympics will not be immune to this looming health crisis. The torch relay is scheduled to start on March 12, only 6 weeks from now, the day after the 9th anniversary of the 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and start of the nuclear triple meltdown disaster at Fukushima Daiichi. Don't you just love the sense of timing used by those clever little PR sausages? Back to the point. If the world is in quarantine, lockdown, whole countries in an isolation ward, what are the chances that Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo, it's all under control in Fukushima, Abe, will be able to con the world into just going along with the torch relay as planned and even show up at the games themselves? Speaking of odds, to illustrate how dangerous this is being perceived as being, online betting sites are now laying odds on whether the Olympics themselves will even take place in the face of this new potential pandemic. Athletes and spectators alike canceled themselves out of the 2016 games because of the Zika virus threat. Do we actually think things will happen as planned by Japan for these ill-fated 2020 games? So it may not be nuclear concerns that stopped the Olympic torch run through Futaba and 3 full days in Fukushima Prefecture, or stop the softball and baseball games in Fukushima's Akuma Stadium. But if either or both of these things happen, it feels like a karmic payback for a lie that's been hurting the people of northeastern Japan and covering up the nuclear disaster to force them to move back into radioactive zones where they do not want to be. It's going to be interesting to watch the scramble to try to frame this as a there, missy moment, because I don't think the world is going to buy it. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, 9 nights out of the week.
It's gotten to the point where the update on the Radioactive Tokyo 2020 Olympics and Numbnuts of the Week really should be one feature because the stories all come from the same gene pool. But here's our Numbnuts. Japan's Fukushima Prefecture, in a statement on Tuesday, January 21st, reassured the public that participants and spectators at the Olympic torch relay this year need not worry about radiation exposure. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen. They're just saying, "There, there, Missy, don't worry your pretty little head about it." Now, in next week's Nuclear Hot Seat, you will hear an interview with Beverly Finlay Kaneko, the Voices from Japan co-producer here at Nuclear Hot Seat, on what the real story is regarding the Olympic torch relay, which is now supposed to be going through Futaba, the town that hosted the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station, is still considered part of the difficult-to-return zone, with radiation levels well above that allowed in the Chernobyl exclusion zone, but perceptions of which are being manipulated so that people think that everything is A-OK. Now, as regards radiation exposure, the TEPCO and Japanese government wonks may have gone through and done their little decommissioning dance, picking up the soil and putting it in bags, having monitors that are lifted above the ground so they're not getting the readings of what's actually happening on the ground, placing those monitors in the middle of spots that have been cleaned up where the radiation is much higher, only a short distance away, like 10, 12 feet, and ignores the dangers of recontamination of the area from rain, dust, forest stuff blowing off the mountain, which is something that can never be cleaned up. Plus, there's no indication of a difference between internal and external radiation. They're going by what comes at you from the outside, but you breathe it in, it gets on your lips and you lick it, you eat or drink something. Bubba, it's in your body, up close and personal with your internal organs, and that's a problem. You'll hear more details on how this posing that it's perfectly safe to run through Futaba, a site that has radiation levels more than four times above that allowed in the Chernobyl exclusion zone, on next week's show in our interview with Beverly. But for now, Fukushima Prefecture and the officials who actually tried this piece of manipulative propagandistic reassurance, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Looking internationally, we heard from recent Nuclear Hot Seat interviewee Angela Bischoff of the Ontario Clean Air Alliance that it is unanimous that it has been decided by the Pickering City Council that the Pickering Nuclear Power Station in Ontario, Canada, should be immediately dismantled. Pickering Mayor and the Council unanimously supported a resolution calling for the Pickering Nuclear Station to be dismantled as expeditiously as possible, their term, after it is shut down in 2024. This is in keeping with the recommendation of the International Atomic Energy Agency that immediate dismantling is, quote, the preferred decommissioning strategy, end quote, for nuclear plants. Ontario Power Generation insisted that the plant should be mothballed for 30 years before dismantling, an option that is in OPG's financial self-interest, but does nothing for the local community. Pickering councillors, on the other hand, looked at the many benefits of immediate dismantling and came to a different conclusion about what is best for their community. In Sweden, a majority of their parliament rejected a proposal from the nationalistic Swedish Democrats to stop Vattenfall AB's plans to close two nuclear reactors. These reactors were commissioned in 1975 and 76, and now the shutdown will proceed as planned. Romania's government will exit a deal with their Chinese partner for the construction of two nuclear reactors at the Cernavoda nuclear power plant. Prime Minister Ludovic Orban said that all new projects in Romania's energy sector will depend on the European Union's Green Deal from now on, an initiative aimed at reducing CO2 emissions in the European Union. As we reported last week, the EU's Just Transition Fund supports countries that are transitioning to genuine renewable energy sources and specifically excludes nuclear. Turkey has canceled an agreement with a Japan-led consortium to build a 4,500-megawatt nuclear plant in Sinop in northern Turkey along the Black Sea coast. This would have been Turkey's second nuclear plant. The Japanese and Turkish governments originally agreed to this venture in 2013. Russia's state-owned energy firm Rosatom is already constructing the first Turkish nuclear plant, which is not scheduled to become operational until 2023. In France, the Sortir du Nucléaire Network is filing a complaint against an Orano advertising campaign, which presents nuclear energy as a solution for climate change. Orano is a multinational nuclear fuel cycle company created in 2017 as a result of restructuring of the nuclear conglomerate Areva, Areva being the much more familiar term to listeners of this show. Why the legal action? Because Orano has been sending out advertising about nuclear power as being the solution to climate change. That's such a big lie, their nose must be growing. Sortir du Nucléaire claims that the false statement is intended to boost investments in a declining sector and denounces the association. And in Russia, Vladivostok Customs has stopped a radioactive Toyota Prius that arrived from Japan. The dangerous cargo was contaminated with beta-active radionuclides, according to the city's customs press secretary. The car will now be shipped back to Japan. This is the first case in 3 years of a radioactive vehicle arriving from Japan that was detected by Russian customs. This most recent case shows that the consequences of the 2011 Fukushima nuclear accident have not been completely eliminated, said the head of the radioactive department of Vladivostok Customs. We'll have this week's featured interviews in just a moment. But first, hey, does it strike you that the whole world is heating up? Not just from climate change issues, but because it's starting to wake up to the fact that nuclear issues and problems are real and growing. I know the number of stories that come to Nuclear Hot Seat feels overwhelming at times, because so many people in so many places are doing such good work at exposing the truth and bringing honest information about nukes into the public eye. That's one of the purposes of this show, you know. To make you aware of the work against nuclear that's going on by individuals around the world, the people who are doing it, what has worked, what's in the planning stages, and how you, how anyone can get involved. And another big purpose is to acknowledge activists who have been doing the work, to give them an attagirl or attaboy or attawhatever, to help keep them in good heart as they tackle what they see as their part in stopping the nuclear industry. Now, as I've shared here before, the only thing that keeps Nuclear Hot Seat going is the support of listeners like you. There's no better time than right now to make that donation that you've been thinking about giving. It will go to support the website makeover, which is in progress even as we speak, and more importantly, all the services needed to put the show itself together and get this information out to the world. Let's face it. Nuclear Hot Seat is the one place you can count on every week to give you a one-hour hit of honest nuclear information. So if you want to stop nukes, help us get the word out with a donation. It's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to send a donation of any size. And to send us a monthly $5, the same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S., just click on the big green donate button at nuclearhotseat.com. Please, do what you can now, and know that however much you can help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Here's this week's featured interview. Tiffany Hansen is director of Rocky Flats Downwinders, a community organization founded in 2015 to advocate on behalf of those impacted by living downwind from the former Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant near Arvada, Colorado. That's very close to Boulder. The organization came together through common concern about the high rate of illness suffered by former residents in the communities surrounding Rocky Flats. Their main goals are to bring about awareness of Rocky Flats in order to educate the community, to sensitize medical professionals regarding the potential adverse health effects suffered by downwinders, and to offer support services for downwinders. Tiffany Hansen had a lot to share about two recent Rocky Flats studies, a health survey and what one might call a hemp survey. We spoke on January 20th, 2020.
Tiffany Hansen, thank you for joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks for having me.
Rocky Flats Downwinders recently announced that you have an initial report from the Rocky Flats Hemp Phytoremediation Pilot Project. What is that project and how did it come about?
We received a grant from the Roddenberry Foundation that we got at the beginning of last year, 2019, for our Rocky Flats Phytoremediation Pilot Project, which was basically the idea of how can we see if hemp is able to uptake plutonium from contaminated soil as a way for communities to potentially clean up their own environments. If they know they're in a contaminated spot, is hemp something that would be helpful to them? Was the focus of the project.
Why hemp?
Hemp because, well, I'm passionate about hemp. Hemp is now legal in so many states, and people are talking a lot about CBD and using cannabis and hemp for medicinal purposes. When you do some just quick Google searches, there's a lot of kind of popular articles that say hemp has the ability to do, you know, cleaning up soil and radionuclides, and there's been testing done in Chernobyl, and there's a lot of kind of popular comments about its use, but I could not find any scholarly or journal articles that actually showed the science behind it. And so I wanted to get more information, and so hemp seemed like it was out there, it was mentioned, but again, I couldn't find anything in the science.
For listeners who may not be familiar with Rocky Flats, tell us why such a study was needed.
So Rocky Flats is a former nuclear weapons facility near Arvada, Colorado, that made plutonium triggers for 40 years and is known to have off-site contamination. It's currently an active Superfund site in the middle of the property, and it's surrounded by a open wildlife refuge.
Or at least what they're calling a wildlife refuge, because
yeah.
Animals can't vote. So what was announced was an initial report on this study. What do these initial findings show?
So in talking with Dr. Michael Ketterer, who did the analysis, and with the owner of Ruby Hemp Solutions, and hearing from them after they reviewed the initial findings, it sounds like the project was successful in that Michael Ketterer is convinced and surprised, based on the findings, it looks like hemp was able to uptake plutonium into the plant matter. So we were very excited.
That sounds like it has huge implications for cleanup in general.
I think it's important for cleanup in general, but then on the other side of that, it also makes me think for consumers of hemp-based products that are using hemp or cannabis for medicinal purposes, that we need to be more aware about where those products are grown and make sure they're not near sites that are contaminated, not just with nuclear contamination. If hemp can uptake plutonium, then it's probably able to uptake a lot of other contaminants that are also in communities that you would not want to then turn around and consume.
Who is Michael Ketterer and what is his background?
Dr. Michael Ketterer is a soil scientist and plutonium expert. And he has done work at Rocky Flats. He's also recently been in the media because he did the testing at the Piketon, Ohio location where they discovered radioactive materials in the middle school there. And they closed down the school. And so that's been discussed a lot in the media. So he is the soil scientist who did that work. But he's also worked around Rocky Flats issues for some decades.
What gets done with the plants if they have taken up plutonium? That's great if it's out of the soil, but then mm-hmm. What happens to the plants that have the plutonium in them?
And that's the question that keeps coming up. And so for this project, all of the plant matter was turned into ash to be analyzed. In the future, you know, I hope some scientific organization or some big group will say, oh, look at this. It seems like hemp is going to be valuable to do plutonium remediation. Let's come and think about some ways that we can long-term store the plants. So some discussion that I've heard in that question, because I've had that question throughout the time that this project has been moving forward, and that is, what about burning the plant matter into ash and then storing it between glass for long periods of time? That could be something. I mean, on the other hand, I'm also interested to know, if hemp is able to uptake plutonium, is it able to break down the plutonium in any way? Is the form still going to be the same through that process? I mean, there's, to me, this project just poses more questions, but it shows promise, and much more needs to be thought about in terms of the long-term applicability of a project like this.
Will the Rocky Flats Hemp Phytoremediation Pilot Project be ongoing? And if so, what's next for it?
No, it's not ongoing. We've submitted our final report to the Roddenberry Foundation, and we've received what we needed from Michael Ketterer. We received what we needed from Ruby Hemp Solutions. I do know that Ruby Hemp Solutions hopes to do a bigger paper that could potentially be published in a journal down the road. But the process of doing that kind of scholarly journal article will take some time. But I'm hopeful that that will come out as a result. But in terms of what Rocky Flats Downwinders is doing, we'll share any additional findings or more papers that are published, but we're not going to spend any more time on that, because the focus of our organization is raising awareness about Rocky Flats, which this project really did help, because we were met with a lot of problems. We were denied soil samples initially, so there were some news articles about it. We've had a lot of good awareness building in terms of the project itself, but we have to go back to focusing in on the health concerns that we have in our health surveys, the real focus of the work that we're doing.
As you just mentioned, there's also been an announcement that on January 27, you're launching the Rocky Flats Community Driven Health Survey. What is that and why is it needed?
The Community Driven Health Survey is a health survey that we have put together as a community group to follow up with the Metropolitan State University Health Survey of Rocky Flats Downwinders, which was closed when the principal investigator retired. Carol Jensen retired. There was never anyone that took over that project.
When was that he retired and the study stopped?
Carol Jensen is a female nurse who was the principal investigator, and she retired in 2018, I believe, and the survey was closed then.
Why is it being picked up now?
So we've been working trying to say, how can we recreate something like this? Because the initial preliminary findings of the Metropolitan State Survey showed, out of the 1,725 respondents, 48.8% of them had rare cancers. And so that was announced, and we had a couple community groups that were very well attended, and the media was there, and those findings were concerning. But what didn't happen is any further analysis of the, at the end, 5,000 people had submitted their health information to that survey, but no additional analysis was ever done with that data, and that data remains on site at Metro, and it is not our data. We cannot access it. We don't have any rights to it. So we've been trying to figure out how we can document these health issues, because we're contacted by people with rare cancers, autoimmune diseases, and concerns that they have that their illnesses are caused by Rocky Flats. But we know from meeting with the CDPHE as recently in the last couple months that their cancer registry and the way they monitor health is really not the way we think you ought to. And that is, they're not looking at the health issues around Rocky Flats. They're not monitoring or documenting MS or any autoimmune diseases out there, diabetes, epilepsy, cancers. There's not a built-in alarm system that says, oh, wow, you know, there's been a lot of cases of brain cancer in the area. It takes community groups to request them to do analysis. And then when they do, in the case of Rocky Flats, they use these big areas that include way outside contaminated sites that then dilutes what the findings are. So the reason that we're doing this survey is because we are continued to be contacted by people who are impacted, and we want the data in the hands of the community. I don't, as a single person, want to have these stories that I'm just holding on to in my emails. We want to have a formal way to track and document what the health issues are for those folks who live out there. And honestly, I don't think this problem is going to be going away. In fact, you know, the communities are moving closer and closer to the contaminated areas. And those areas are now, they have a bunch of retail out there. And so the people that are impacted, it's going to continue to happen. I'm sure with the half-life that plutonium has, it's not going away anytime soon.
Not for a minimum of 24,000 years half-life.
Exactly.
If people live in that area and wish to become involved in the survey, how can they participate?
So the survey will be, like you said, launched on January 27th, which is National Downwinders Day, a day to remember and recognize people who have been impacted by living downwind from nuclear testing sites. We'd like that to include also folks that live downwind from nuclear weapons plants and reactors, even storage sites. There's a lot of communities like Rocky Flats downwinders who have been impacted. So the health survey will be available on our website that day. And then everyone who's signed up on our mailing list will also receive an automated email invite to participate. And so it'll be open and ongoing from January 27th on.
And when you say ongoing, is that just for however long it is in process, or is there an end date on it at which point you compile the statistics on it?
At this point, we're just collecting the information. And so that's why we say just continue to be open. If we start to work with some people who analyze the data and they say we need to stop to and close it for a while to look at something, that would be, you know, something we'd be open to also. But we're not scientists. We're just community members who are documenting and tracking the health of the people in the community. So that's something that we just want to continue to, and eventually map, you know, like they did in our first, the Metropolitan State Survey, they've mapped illnesses. We had a woman, Brittany Kelly, who reached out to us, who's been mapping young breast cancer. And so when you can start to see the visuals of where people are impacted with these illnesses around the contamination site, I think those visuals are impactful to the community. So we want to be able to know, is there something that seems excessive? Are there clusters of diseases that need to be brought, again, to the attention of the CDPHE? Like, we'll still bring it up, whether they want to dismiss it or not. We're going to continue to try to see what the real health is of the community through this survey.
And, of course, there is precedent for community groups coming up with crucial information that completely turn around how situations are handled. Most specifically, what comes to mind is in North St. Louis, with the problems around the Mallinckrodt and Coldwater Creek, and also what has been building here in the greater Los Angeles area with Santa Susana Field Lab, Melissa Bumstead, and Physicians for Social Responsibility, the moms who are really getting active in that. So you have precedent for this kind of a study really making a huge difference in how a radioactive problem in a community is perceived, and then the pressure that can be brought to bear on the local officials to get off their rumps and do something about it.
Yes.
If people wish to find out more information, either about the Rocky Flats Hemp Phytoremediation Pilot Project or this health study, where can they go and what should they do?
Our website would be a great place to start, which is just rockyflatsdownwinders.com. And we'll have tabs up that have our hemp phytoremediation page, and we also have our health study page that talks about the first study that I mentioned and also has the preliminary findings there. And Rocky Flats Downwinders is on Facebook and Twitter, and so I encourage people to follow us on social media as well.
Tiffany, you and the group are doing phenomenal work. This is so important to document so that it can be made tangible to those people who count on having the statistics, having the hard data in front of them. All best with both of these. And I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks so much.
Tiffany Hansen. She is director of Rocky Flats Downwinders. You can learn more about the community-driven health survey and the hemp phytoremediation project by going to the group's website, rockyflatsdownwinders.com. Now a San Onofre update on the latest shenanigans by Southern California Edison, because they just never seem to straighten up and fly right. By now, Donna Gilmore should be well known to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners. She is the head of SanOnofreSafety.org, a ferociously focused researcher, analyst, and discoverer of things the nuclear industry would rather you not know about, and she has no hesitation or shyness about sharing what she has learned. If you have a nuclear reactor anywhere near you, Donna provides an ongoing lesson in the kinds of hijinks the nukesters will engage in at the expense of your health, safety, and DNA, meaning your genetic downline. I spoke with Donna Gilmore on Monday, January 27, 2020.
I live within 5 miles of San Onofre, and I received a pamphlet in the mail from Edison saying they were going to start tearing down the domes in the other buildings. You know, say, oh, this is good news. All the domes are, and all the other buildings are going to be gone. Can you start on that after February 22nd? Nowhere in that brochure did they tell the residents, this went to 12,000 households, nowhere did that tell the residents that the nuclear waste was going to still be there.
Lying by omission.
Yeah. And the San Diego Tribune just wrote up an article on it, January 26th, and in there it talks about the decommissioning trust fund and implies that Edison contributed money to that the way it's written. But no, all this is ratepayer money. $4.4 billion is there.
That's billion with a B.
Billion with a B. $4.4 billion. Other facilities, they've got a little over maybe $1 billion to do decommissioning. But because we have a monopoly and are forced to pay, Edison was able to get $4.4 billion out of the Public Utility Commission. And most of this they want to use to tear down the buildings, including the spent fuel pools. And the pools are the only NRC-approved method that they have on site to replace canisters that they all admit are damaged. Every one of the canisters, and they've got over 40 of the new ones loaded, are damaged. And yet they've got the green light from our state agencies and the NRC to take out the pools without any other method to make sure these containers are transportable or can be replaced or repaired or even inspected. This is outrageous.
So having seen this flyer that lied by omission and this article that has skirted around a harder truth than it might have reported on, what kind of response have you put together, and what do you suggest that others do to at least get some honest information out there into the hands of local residents?
Well, to be clear, the San Diego Tribune article, yeah, Edison didn't mention the pools in their pamphlet, but the San Diego Tribune article mentioned it, so that, to their credit, they mentioned it. But there's a lie being told by Edison that they will eventually be able to repair these canisters, which isn't true. They can't even find the cracks, let alone repair them. That they can take a leaking canister and put it inside a transport cap or something else. That's not true either. The NRC has not even evaluated the possibility of taking these super hot canisters, as they are, let alone leaking, and put it in a transport cask. It wouldn't pass a thermal analysis. These canisters have to be air-cooled around them, and you put them in a thick wall cask, you've lost your cooling system, and, you know, the thing will overheat and become damaged. So basically, we're getting a stranded solution by Edison, by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, by the State Lands Commission, by the Coastal Commission, by the Public Utility Commission, all of them. So you're really talking the governor of California, because that's who controls the state agencies, and you're talking about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is controlled by 4 or 5 commissioners. The NRC commissioners are appointed by the president, but they have to be confirmed by the Senate. And there's only one token safety-conscious commissioner on that commission. Jeff Barron, appointed by Obama. The problem is the Senate has to confirm them, and with the makeup of the Senate and now with the makeup of the president, we don't have a chance of having our safety by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. This election, this primary that's coming up in California in March, may be the most important vote anyone ever makes. They need to change the makeup of the Senate. They need to change the makeup of who's president. make sure they vote for a candidate, that you can go to their website and see where they clearly stand on nuclear energy issues. I was shocked to hear Elizabeth Warren supporting keeping aging nuclear reactors going. She's kind of flip-flopped there. Right now, Bernie Sanders is the only one that seems to get it, who seems to understand that nuclear energy is at a dead end and we need to stop it as soon as possible. I've researched every candidate, and that's pretty much it.
Donna, this is all quite frightening information, and you're always so spot on with what it is that you have researched and the information you bring forward. It is completely verifiable. What can we do in this circumstance?
SantaOnofreeSafety.org. There's a petition right at the top of the page to reach out to our elected. It's going to go to the governor and Nancy Pelosi and some others. And basically, it's a support and just to sign the petition and pass it along. Get the numbers up on this petition so they know the voters care. And what it advocates for is recalling these defective thin wall canisters, replacing them with thick wall casks that are inspectable, maintainable, and can be monitored in a way so we don't have to evacuate California. The Swiss already have what we're asking for. This isn't some crazy citizens and activist solution. The Swiss already have this implemented. They have a hot cell. They use thick cast stored in buildings. They can monitor. They can inspect inside and out. They can replace thick cast if they need to in their hot cell facility. So there's already an example out there. It can be done. There's money in the decommissioning trust fund. That should be prioritized to replace these cracking canisters, these lemons, as soon as possible. And the money, the $4.4 billion, most of it was allocated to tearing down the domes and the other buildings. Those domes can sit there for decades, and it's not going to hurt anything. So we have to prioritize making us safer in California. And each one of these cans holds a Chernobyl disaster's worth of radioactivity. So this is not a minor issue. They're going to have over 100 canisters there with no way to monitor. What they have done is they basically hidden the radiation levels from the older aging canisters that have been sitting there for almost 17 years, some of them. So it's important to go to SantaOnofreeSafety.org, sign the petition, pass it along, reach out to your federal and state elected officials, educate them on this issue. There are handouts and other tools. Contact the website if you want to help basically save California and beyond, actually, because these canisters, once they breach, they are at risk for nitrogen gas explosions, which could send the waste, just like the smoke traveled from the campfire, all across the United States. So this is really a national issue.
Donna, I know you'll keep us informed as to the latest at San Onofre, and thanks so much for this update.
Yeah, I want to say one more thing. This isn't my recommendation to do this. I want to be clear. This isn't my recommendation that that's what should happen. It's the only friggin' option they've left us with.
Donna, as always, your information is frightening, but you also give us something to do. And that's the important thing, that people can take steps if this in any way upsets you or concerns you. Your website, again, is SantaOnofreeSafety.org. Follow up, take action, and we will keep you informed here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
That was Donna Gilmore of SantaOnofreeSafety.org. Remember, every game that Southern California Edison, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and state agencies are playing around San Onofre is part of a playbook that the industry uses. It's about how to manage people living around other nuclear reactor sites as well as this one in Southern California. It's not a one-off manipulation. It is standard operating procedure, well-coordinated and focus-grouped within the nuclear industry to know how to manage panic, divert attention from real problems, distract opposition, and soothe the public into inaction. Kids, don't you believe them. And don't let this happen to you. Fight back.
Activists, shout out.
First, a sad note. we wish to mark the passing of Ruth Thomas. She was an amazing anti-nuclear activist and a member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She died Sunday, January 26, at age 99. For decades, Ruth Sackett Thomas was one of South Carolina's most ardent anti-nuclear activists. Known for making state leaders uncomfortable with questions about nuclear policy, Thomas spent nearly 50 years advocating environmental causes and fighting the expansion of atomic plants across South Carolina. In 1972, after reading a story about a proposed nuclear reprocessing plant near Barnwell, South Carolina, Thomas founded Environmentalists, Inc. to oppose the facility, which President Jimmy Carter later canceled because of concerns about the potential hazards. In 2015, at the age of 95, Thomas called the state newspaper to say she was working against the shipments of weapons-grade plutonium across the country. The plutonium had at one point been destined for Aiken's Savannah River site. As recently as last month, Thomas was drafting a letter to government officials in Ohio to express concern about nuclear contamination at a site that is being demolished there. Ruth Thomas, rest in peace, because peace is the final frontier. We heard from Arnie Gunderson, who is chief engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education, a data-based site that looks to find out the truth about what's happening in nuclear situations based on the science and solely the science. I love this one. Fairwinds always has to do its science on a shoestring because, well, funding. So now he's talking literally about, in Japan, having science on a shoestring by having people in the torch relay and Olympic athletes in Fukushima sending shoelaces from their shoes to Fairwinds for testing. It could draw attention to ongoing contamination and show these individuals exactly what they have been up against. There are collection protocols that would have to be followed and other information as well. And key to all of this is coming up with the funding. So if you've got some suggestions and would like to help, get in touch with fairwinds.org. And that's Fairwinds with an E, F-A-I-R-E-W-I-N-D-S, plural, .org. For those of you who may not know, Fairwinds is the group that assisted with the testing of the Hanford site, the homes of the workers who were told that they had nothing to worry about. And Fairwinds, through a system they set up, discovered contamination, radiological contamination, in the homes and in the vehicles of contaminated workers. They've also been working with the families around the Santa Susana Field Lab in Southern California for testing of the soil and the dust in the wake of the Woolsey fire, which started at the Santa Susana Field Lab. The state of California agencies are all saying, nothing happened here. The testing is ongoing, and when there are results that can be reported, we will report them here. Now let's see if we can get some shoelaces happening. And I'm going to be popping up on Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis, both a broadcast and an online radio program. This is going to be Thursday evening, January 30th, between 8 and 10 p.m. Pacific time. If you can't catch it live, they always have a rerun available on the site. You can go to groundzeromedia.org to learn all you need to know about this. I'll be on for 2 hours, so hopefully we'll have a chance to really dig deep into some of the issues that I discuss on a weekly basis here. As today's final thought, I'm going to share a poem that was sent to me. It's by L.R. Knost, K-N-O-S-T, and I was not familiar with this person's work, but I found this particular piece, which is very brief, very moving. It reads, "Do not be dismayed by the brokenness of the world. All things break, and all things can be mended. Not with time, as they say, but with intention. So go. Love intentionally, extravagantly, unconditionally. The broken world waits in darkness for the light that is you." This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 28, 2020. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, lohud.org, thebulletin.org, bsnorell.blogspot.com, gothamist.com, theecologist.com, republicworld.com, diaspoir.net, bloomberg.com, romania-insider.com, ibtimes.com, siberiantimes.com, nukeresistor.org, and information sent to me through email, Facebook messages, and however other way that I get it, from activists and just concerned people around the world. A reminder that Nuclear Hot Seat is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. So however you're listening to it now, know that there are plenty of ways out there for you to subscribe. If there's a platform you like that we've missed, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com and we will get on that as well. And if you want an easy way to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered by email every week, just go to the website, nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow box, especially if you're on a tablet or a smartphone, you may have to go for a while, and sign up for a weekly email, which will give you the link to the latest show and a short description of some of the features that are in it. I want to thank all of you for listening and joining with Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world in 123 countries on 6 continents and counting. Still trying to get Antarctica and haven't gotten there yet. Now, many of the stories that I do here on Nuclear Hot Seat are sourced through listeners like you who know something, see something, and think it should be shared. If you know a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send it to me at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate having a weekly verifiable news update about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment, go to the website, look at those big red and green buttons that are there for donations, and please consider supporting us. We will be extremely grateful for anything you can do. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020, Libby Halevy and Hartestree Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevy of Hartestree Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that acute radiation illness, such as what comes from massive doses the Chernobyl liquidators received, that is an accident. But chronic radiation syndrome, such as we are all exposed to at low doses from accidents, reactor releases, leftover fallout from atmospheric bomb tests, and other stupid nuke tricks. Chronic radioactive syndrome is a crime, and we are all its victims. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So here's the brief. Do not go back to sleep. That's because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.